All right, we are looking more at things happening in the 1600s. We are going to shift our attention very quickly now toward the New World. In fact, I try to make sure that we're seeing when the different colonies get started as we're progressing here. Because since we're here in America, in the United States in particular, we want to kind of know how things progressed here. It'll be nice to know how things elsewhere kind of affected it, but mostly we're going to want to see how things were happening here in our own particular country. So right around 1624, you've got the Dutch West Indies Company that is operating in the New World. And these guys established what's called the New Netherlands. And that is eventually going to encompass what we know of today as New York and New Jersey. And since the Reformed faith of Calvin, you know, Zwingli, those guys, that was part of the whole Dutch culture, that was what was being imported into the New World in that particular part of the Atlantic seaboard. Now, you should keep in mind something we talked about already. During the period of exploration, you've got the French, for the most part, are coming across way far in the north, going down the St. Lawrence Seaway, that'd be north of what we call Maine, so down the St. Lawrence Seaway, down into the Great Lakes, and then they jump across and go down the Mississippi Valley, and they end up down in Louisiana. So that's kind of the French territory. Now, what's the religion of France? Catholic. So you've got French Catholicism being established through that region of North America. Now, down in the south, you've got the Spaniards. And they came a little bit earlier, but they're still active right around this time. So they came across and they kind of took over the Caribbean area, up into the Florida region. Then they kind of jumped across to Mexico, over into Baja California, Southern California, and a little bit down toward South America. So what religion is predominant amongst the Spaniards? Catholic again, all right? Now, the Portuguese, they have decided they're going to focus more to the south of where Spain's doing their work. So they're down in South America. Think about Brazil, places like that. What religion are the Portuguese? Catholic again. So you've got Roman Catholicism that is taking over quite a bit of the New World. But there on that mid-Atlantic area, just north of Florida, up to just the southern part of Maine, that's where the English and the Dutch, and I suppose in some extent a little bit of the Germans, but they're kind of connected in with the Dutch and stuff. They're the ones that are pumping their attention into that region there, and what is their predominant religion? Protestantism. And this will help you understand why Protestantism became the major belief system of the United States when it gets its start. Because here we're seeing colonies that are being established in that region. Now, we've been talking about the kings of England in particular, the kings and queens of England, when they're reigning, because that does impact on the English immigrants. So in 1625, a new king comes to the throne. His name is Charles. He reigns until 1649. Now, he's automatically the head of the Church of England. That's their government now, right? But he's married in the early part of his reign to a 15-year-old French Catholic princess. And that arouses concern within Parliament, because Parliament is focused on Protestantism, on the idea that we are not a Catholic nation. We've been fighting against the idea of Catholicism here in England for quite some time. So they're a little bit suspicious of this guy. During 1629 to 1640, he reigned without parliament because he had it in his head, divine right of kings. Now, that's pretty old school. It went way back in time that the kings thought, I'm here because God put me and my family here, and I get to call the shots. And so he's a little bit of a throwback to that idea, so he doesn't figure, I don't need parliament in order to get my stuff done. But they were trying to push through some resolutions at the tail end of 1629 or so to try to condemn Catholicism and Arminianism. We talked about Arminianism last week, remember that? Because Calvinism was the basic philosophy of the Church of England and the Puritans and the Separatists that were coming out of the Church of England. And so they were not happy with Arminianism still hanging around. And so they tried to put an end to that. And they also did not like Catholicism. And in their minds, the Parliament's minds, those two things kind of went together. And so he also aroused some Scottish opposition to his reign when he tried to force Anglican procedures, that's just another name for Church of England procedures, when it's outside the bounds of England. So he tried to force Church of England practices on the Presbyterians up in Scotland. And that was starting in 1633, did not make the Scots happy because they felt that was an infringement upon their religious freedom. 1634, King Charles did grant to Lord Baltimore. Now, that's a title. That's not actually his name. Calvert, I think, was actually his name. But he granted to Lord Baltimore permission to establish a safe haven for Catholics within a new colony that was going to be named Maryland. And Maryland was to be named that after his wife. Remember? The French Catholic princess. And so this is how the Maryland colony became the place in the New World where the majority of Catholics settled. But it wasn't just a Catholic colony. You should understand that pretty quickly. Because many of these Catholics that were going to the New World felt that the prejudice and the persecution of the Church of England against them, it kind of made them feel sorry for some of the other non-Church of England groups. And so when Maryland gets established, and I'm going to jump ahead just a little bit, they very quickly put out the Maryland Toleration Act of 1649. So that's jumping ahead a little bit. Once they've been established and they start getting not just simply Catholics settling there, but they've also got non-Catholic Protestants who don't fit Church of England standards. So this is excerpts from this Toleration Act. Whatsoever person or persons within this province and the islands thereunto belonging shall therefore henceforth blaspheme God, that is, curse him, or deny our Savior Jesus Christ to be the Son of God, or shall deny the Holy Trinity, the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, or the Godhead of any of the said three persons of the Trinity, or the unity of the Godhead, or shall use or utter any reproachful speeches, words, or language concerning the said Holy Trinity, or any of the said three persons thereof, shall therefore be punished with death and confiscation or forfeiture of all his or her lands and goods to the Lord Proprietary and his heirs. Now that's pretty serious stuff there. So Maryland was established not just simply as a Catholic colony, it was established as a Trinitarian non-Church of England colony. And they took their Trinitarian Christianity very seriously. Now, this is another example, and there are plenty of them, that the United States, in its inception, was a Christian nation, in the sense that they took Christianity seriously enough to make laws about it, that you could not violate some of the principal documents or dogmas or doctrines of biblical Christianity. Now, the next one goes on to basically talk about, and if you say anything nasty about Mary, the mother of our Savior, or the holy apostles, or the evangelists, then you will be fined, basically, for the first offense. Second offense, they'll double the fine, and you'll probably be publicly whipped. And then a third offense, you're going to get fined even more, get whipped, and probably thrown in prison. So if you blaspheme God or the Holy Trinity, that's execution. But if you blaspheme Mary or the apostles or any of the people involved in the writing of the New Testament, you're going to get yourself fined big time, whipped, and sent to jail for as long as the person who's in charge of Maryland feels it is appropriate. So again, they take this stuff pretty seriously. That being said, this is the part that I think you should find very interesting. Whatsoever person or persons shall from henceforth, upon any occasion of offense or otherwise, in a reproachful manner or way, declare, call, or denominate any person or persons whatsoever inhabiting, residing, trafficking, trading, or commercing within this province or with any of the ports, harbors, creeks, or havens to the same belonging as a heretic. So if you called somebody a heretic, that would be covered by this. A schismatic, an idolater, a Puritan, an independent, a Presbyterian, a popish priest, a separatist, Jesuited, Papist, Lutheran, Calvinist, Anabaptist, Brownist, Antinomian, Barrowist, Roundhead, Separatist, or any other name or term in a reproachful manner relating to matter of religion, shall for each such offense forfeit and lose the sum of 10 shillings sterling, or the same value in property. And then half of that is to be paid to the person you offended by calling them a nasty name because of their religion. So they get 5 shillings. Then the governor of the colony would get, Lord Baltimore in this case, would get the other 5 shillings. And of course, if you kept doing it, there'd be other penalties that would be popped up. You'd be fined more and more, and you'd probably be whipped, possibly imprisoned. Now, the point of this that I wanted you to hear is they were basically saying everybody needs to mind their manners when it comes to the faith of other Protestants and Catholics in this colony. No name calling. Behave yourselves. Otherwise, you're going to pay a penalty for it. Oh, my goodness, yeah. There'd be a lot of fining going on. But I wanted you to see that that was kind of how Maryland gets started, is basically a place where they said, everybody just mind your own business and behave yourselves. Okay? The last part, though, the last excerpt that I want to read to you, and for those of you who just popped in, this is from the Maryland Toleration Act of 1649, so it's about 14 years after they got started as a colony. This last part lets you know that even though they were telling people you need to mind your own business when it comes to the matters of the Christian religion, whatever group you're part of, you are still expected to live a righteous lifestyle in this colony. Every person or persons within this province that shall at any time hereafter profane the Sabbath or Lord's Day, called Sunday, by frequent swearing, drunkenness, or by any uncivil or disorderly recreation, or by working on that day when absolute necessity does not require it, shall for every such first offense forfeit half of 5 shillings, okay? For the second offense, 5 shillings. Third offense, 10 shillings. And if you can't pay for it, then your first and second offense, you're going to be imprisoned. Until you will appear before the magistrate and apologize, saying what I did was wrong. Third offense and onward, you get publicly whipped for profaning the Sabbath day by engaging in inappropriate, immoral behavior. There was a little bit of political correctness, but it was more religious correctness. Okay? So again, you're seeing here the establishment of religious principles within the colonies. By this, they have both, they're making the laws based on things they're seeing in Scripture.
You mentioned one of the names of
the roundheads. Well, we'll actually get to that in a moment here. It was a nasty name applied to Protestants in England. Of the Puritan background, okay? All right, so that's the Maryland thing. And by the way, you can look all these things up. One of the wonderful things about having the internet is you can go back and look at the original material from the founding of our colonies, see what they said. And so there is no way in the world that anybody should get away with saying the United States was established as a secular nation. That is a huge lie. And all you have to do is go back and read their original documents of their establishment of their governments. And you know for a fact that they're lying to your face when they say that. Or they're stupid. Didn't bother to check it out themselves after they had some professor tell them that. All right, back to our handout. 1635, Connecticut gets established as a refuge for Puritans and Separatists. Separatists are also starting to be called Congregationalists because they have a congregational form of church government. It's local, okay? So they were under the leadership of a guy by the name of Reverend, that was his title, Thomas Hooker. These guys ran into problems with the governing authorities in Massachusetts because Massachusetts, remember, that was where Plymouth Colony got started. They were a separatist colony, but they had their own ideas of what separatism should look like. Hooker wanted it to be a little bit different than that. And so they went, no, you can't be doing that stuff here. And so he goes, fine, I'll go do it somewhere else. So he goes to what's the colony now of Connecticut and gets it started. 1636, Rhode Island gets established as a separate colony because Roger Williams, who is the founder of the first Baptist church in America, so he was dealing with separatists in Massachusetts, kind of just like Hooker was, but he believed that there should be more adherence to Bible things than rules written by local leaders. And so that's how the Baptist Church gets started in the Rhode Island. You've also got a woman that's connected to him. Her name is Anne Hutchinson. And here was what kind of got her in trouble in Massachusetts. She wanted to have in-home Bible studies. Imagine that. Have something outside the church building. And that got her in trouble in Massachusetts. And so she goes over there to Rhode Island with Williams, and the Rhode Island establishes their rules to allow such things. 1636 was also the establishment of Harvard College. And you can go back and read some of the material about Harvard. Now, when you think about Harvard today, what do you think about? Anything? Law school, probably. Something like that. Medical school. Liberal. You'd think very liberal. Hotbed of anti-Christian mindset. Yeah. Well, here's some of the history written within just a few years after it was established, explaining how it got established. After God had carried us safe to New England, and we built our houses, provided necessities for our livelihood, reared convenient places for God's worship, and led the civil government, one of the next things we longed for and looked after was to advance learning and perpetuate it to posterity, dreading to leave an illiterate ministry to the churches when our present ministers shall lie in the dust. So what was the purpose of founding Harvard College? It was a preacher school. A separatist preacher school. So a Protestant preacher school. A little bit farther into the story. Over the college is Master Dunster, placed as president, a learned and conscionable and industrious man, who has so trained up his pupils in the tongues and arts and so seasoned them with the principles of divinity and Christianity that we have to our grand comfort and in truth beyond our hopes beheld their progress in learning and godliness also. The former of these has appeared in their public demonstration or declamations in Latin and Greek and disputations, logic and philosophy. And the latter has been manifested in sundry by them by the savory things of their spirits in their godly versation, insomuch that we are confident if these early blossoms may be cherished and warmed with the influence of the friends of learning and lovers of this pious work, they will, by the help of God, come to happy maturity in a short time. So these basically were saying, we are so glad to have the president of this college helping these young men in particular come to a full and masterful understanding of biblical languages and how to deal with the Bible and how to live the godly Christian life, because this is going to help the churches here in Massachusetts. Now, I am guessing that Harvard never talks about its history again in the modern time. They sheared off the Harvard Divinity School from the main university quite some time ago. But even the Divinity School is very liberal. It was taken over by liberals in the late 1800s, which started the fundamentalist movement in reaction to that, by the way. But what we'll see here as part of our church history is this pattern happens. A religious group, particularly a Protestant religious group, starts a college that is intended to be a preacher training college. Not too long after the original people involved in the founding of the college are no longer involved, they've either died or moved somewhere else or retired, a new group comes in and they start importing more liberal-minded professors. And shortly thereafter, the school goes liberal. And even starts acting against the principles of the original founders. And so the few people that remain that were still attached to the original intent of the school, if they hang on at all, they finally give up and a new school is started somewhere else with the same original principles. and the process starts over again. And that cycle has happened at least five times since the time of Harvard getting started. And I see it happening right now again with restoration colleges that were started in the 40s and 50s. Yes, it is a repeated cycle, and it doesn't just happen in learning academies. It happens in churches as well, where a church will be founded on biblical principles, and as soon as those that were involved in that are no longer really engaged in keeping it fine-tuned, there's an infiltration that often happens, and it becomes liberal over time. Oh, yeah, it happened in Judaism. Judaism is another example where this cycle is repeated quite a bit in its history. When you read the history of the Jews from Solomon onward, it's that cycle again. You'll have strong people that get things back on track, and then after they're dead, it starts going downhill again. And then new revival, then back into the liberalism. It's a repeated thing. There's only one way to combat it, and that is to be constantly vigilant within the congregation, within the Academy of Learning, to make sure people who are not committed to Bible principles never get a foothold. That is the only way you can do it. And here's the problem. If you take that sort of tough stand, you get called names. And you get told that you're worrying about nothing. I'll give you an example. Most recently, I complained, along with a couple of other people, about removing Christian from the name of the church camp. And I got called names and told that I was worrying about nothing. But I have seen too much history that is how those sorts of things happen. It's the camel's nose in the tent syndrome. And you all know about that, right? If you let the camel's nose get into the tent and leave it alone, pretty soon the whole camel's in there. That's the way it happens. Okay, people want to jump in. Larry. Well, yeah.
And, you know, so I just wonder, you know, we're fighting the same battle today as they did that liberalism. But I just wonder how the church of today that we think is conservative would stack up against the church back then that they thought was liberal.
Well, yeah. It would be a mixture, because some of the churches that considered themselves very conservative back at that time were still very much focused on philosophy. And so you had to learn systematized theology and stuff like that, or you were considered a liberal. And I don't see us really needing to focus on that stuff personally. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you have it in today's congregations. It's just interesting.
It is. How many of you have seen the film Chariots of Fire? The story of Eric Liddell. If you remember, part of the whole thing involved in that was that Liddell felt that he should not do anything recreational on Sunday, because that was what the Church of Scotland had taught him since he was a little bitty kid. And that really goes back to this time period. In here, one of the things that we just read in the Massachusetts one, not Massachusetts, Maryland one, was part of the rule was you didn't recreate on Sunday. You were not allowed to do anything enjoyable. The only thing you were supposed to do on a Sunday was go to church, eat, and pray, and converse quietly with one another about more serious things of life. Yeah, and then that kind of continued. But is there anything in the Bible that would indicate that that's the way you're supposed to do anything? No. There's no rules about that in the Scripture. So that is actually a man-made rule. But you see, what you were just talking about, the people back at that time would look at us as being very liberal by allowing that sort of stuff to happen. When I would go, there's nothing biblical about that. Leave it alone. Mind your own business. If they put sleep in there? Well, you've heard me bemoan the fact that we've lost blue laws. Blue laws actually came out of that same mindset. Everything was closed down on Sunday. Unless it was absolutely a necessity, like a hospital or, you know, the police and fire. Everything else was closed down. But we liberalized on that because, honestly, there is nothing in the Scripture about not being able to do certain things on a Sunday. Now, if you want to get into the Sabbath question, the Sabbatarian rest was never part of the New Testament requirement. And besides that, the Sabbath is not Sunday. It's Sunday. It's Saturday. Oh, yeah, no, it was very much preached when we were much younger because that was this norm. But the fact of the matter is that over time, yes, those blue laws finally disappeared, and because of that, our society is much more secular. I hate seeing kids practicing soccer and having tournaments and stuff on Sunday morning when I'm driving over here. It's frustrating. But my other option is to make laws about it, and I'm like, nope, I don't think that's appropriate either. So we're going to have to, I don't know, balance that out in our own heads somehow. Go ahead, John. Yep.
And they're making both of them before the judge even does anything. There's a 6-month grace period for them to try to reconcile.
Yeah, a cooling off period. Yep.
So that's, I mean, there's stuff out there that tries to help, I guess, some laws that I never heard of, I guess. Some states will still have that type of thing.
Yeah, those things will be kind of leftovers from the early establishment of these colonies and things, where marriage was taken very seriously. But hardly any of those are left. Maryland would be probably one of the few where there's even anything where they try to make you think twice before you get a divorce. All right, back to our timeline here. 1638, you've got Delaware was part of New Sweden. And of course, Sweden, Switzerland, that area was Reformed Church, and so that's kind of what the colonists that were coming to New Sweden were from a Reformed background, Calvinistic, okay? Finally things kind of blew up on King Charles because he's got the Bishops' War of Scotland in 1639 and 1640 because of his meddling. That's the way they would have put it, his meddling in Scottish church affairs. And so they're fighting back against him on that. The Irish Rebellion of 1641 was related to some of his policies because you've got native and longtime immigrant Catholic majorities are being kind of invaded by English and Scottish Protestant immigrants. And those guys are getting favored by some of the English laws. And that kind of sets the tone for Irish Catholic versus English Protestants. How many of you remember all that fight still going on not too long ago? Okay? That is back at this time, that was all getting its start. Then you've got the first English Civil War, 1641 to 1649, and that was also kicked off by his actions in religious matters. You've got the Roundheads. This is what you're asking about. They're called that because of the Puritan tendency to keep a shaved head or a very close cropped head, so they had rounded heads, right? So it was a nasty, derogative term for a Puritan. They were the pro-parliamentarians. Basically, Parliament, the Protestant Parliament, should call the shots. Then you've got the Cavaliers. That's because they had a lot of horsemen. And they were the supporters of Charles, you know, the divine right of kings. Kings get to call the shots when it comes to religious matters. And so they fight back and forth, and a lot of people die. During the middle of all this, it's interesting, the Puritans that are in the Parliament, they've managed to pretty much outlaw Christmas. Now, you find that a little bit weird. It's like, what? But you've got to remember that the Puritans were trying to purify their society. And they felt there was way too much overindulgence and exuberance that was attached to Christmas celebrations. And so they said, enough of that nonsense. We're just going to shut the whole thing down. There won't be a Christmas celebration. Christmas is going to be a day like any other day. You work. That went on the whole time that they were kind of in control of the Parliament. Well, Charles finally gets grabbed into custody in 1647. He gets put on trial for treason. He's executed in January 1649, partly because of his belief in the divine right of kings, but also because he really never strongly supported Puritan Calvinism within the Church of England. So what this is letting us know, I think, is that Protestantism comes into existence because they felt that the Pope and his bishops and all those guys, they had way too much say in how governments got run. But when the Puritans and the Separatists kind of get into their own power structure within government, guess what? They start throwing their weight around as well. And so the people underneath them are like, you can't be doing that. The whole principle of us breaking away from Rome was everybody should be able to read the Bible and live according to what they're seeing there, not have some government come in and tell them how to run their lives. And so it just proves again this principle we've talked about before. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Yep, it is exactly what we keep seeing happening as people get this power. Well, when Charles is executed, the English government is kind of run by the Parliament for a little while exclusively. They establish a Council of State that's going to do it for a little while. But it was during that period of time that you've got the rise of the Quakers. 1650 is the key event for that. You've got a guy by the name of George Fox. He had been convinced in his heart that God spoke to him and told him how to live his life. And so he started teaching that that is what everybody should do. And because of that, there was no real need for any type of clergy. None. You just waited and let God tell you what to do. You really didn't even need to study the Bible all that much. So he gets brought up on charges of religious blasphemy by the Church of England. And during the trial, he basically tells the people on the court, you need to tremble at the word of God. And so that's where they started calling these guys a bunch of Quakers. Get the connection there? Okay? These guys just believe you need to quake it in front of God. You don't need any people to tell you how to understand the Bible. And, of course, they refer to them as the Society of Friends, and they had a whole bunch of other names. But they are another dissident group that starts coming under persecution. 1653, Parliament decides that they're just going to make Oliver Cromwell, their leader of that time period, into the Lord Protector of the Commonwealth of England and Wales. Later they'll include Scotland and Ireland in it. And that'll happen for another 7 years while this guy's alive. And 1653, that's when North Carolina gets established as an overflow colony for England's Virginia colony. And of course, it's a government colony. So what church is going to be in charge of it? Church of England. They'll have a few people from these dissidents there, but not a bunch. It's mostly a Church of England colony. An anti-Christmas Puritan attitude continues during this period, and it spreads a little bit to the northern colonies of New England. Okay, so the New Englanders are not big into Christmas during this period of time. It's only the people from the Netherlands, from Sweden, from Germany. These are the ones that still kind of celebrate Christmas. 1655, Delaware gets switched over to become part of New Netherlands because the just changes in government. Cromwell dies in 1658, and his son kind of takes over the role. It's kind of weird. Even though Cromwell was against the idea of an inherited monarchy, he turned his leadership position over to his son and thought that that was a good idea. Now, I don't know about you, but that sounds a little bit like monarchy to me, an inherited monarchy. And apparently the Parliament agreed, didn't like the idea. This guy was not very good. So they remove him from office in 1659, which starts a whole unstabilized period of time. So 1660, the English governor of Scotland decides, you know what, this is ridiculous. We were better off when we had a king. So he goes down to England, and he supports putting the son of Charles, who had been executed, on the throne. So we've got King Charles II, who starts his reign in 1660. And so England goes back to being a constitutional monarchy. Now, how does that affect things? Well, 1660, Parliament grants pardons to all but 50 people who were involved in the execution of the king. But they decide to take reprisals on even the dead people that were involved in that. So they dig up Oliver Cromwell's body, supposed body. His body may have been moved, and they might have got some other guy's body, but they put it on trial, condemn it, and then chop his head off. Now, isn't that just fun? Okay. But they also decided, you know what, this Puritan nonsense that had been going around about no Christmas celebrations, we're going to put a stop to that, and we're going to have Christmas again. 1662, you've got a new act of conformity that is put in place. This requires that all clergy be ordained by the Church of England and that British office holders had to be members of the Church of England. And any ministers and practitioners and nonconformist sects continued to be subject to fines and imprisonment wherever the Church of England ruled. So basically, all the southern colonies where the Church of England was in charge, if you were a nonconformist, like a separatist, a Puritan, a Quaker, any of those guys, you could be fined if you got caught doing your stuff. If you were having a home Bible study, like a Baptist, you could be caught and be fined. So that really did cause most of the nonconformists to go up to the north, to be involved in all those northern colonies that were started by the separatists and by those that were dissenting from the Church of England. 1663, you've got South Carolina. It's deeded to 8 English aristocrats as reward for their service to the crown. And, of course, Church of England is charged because the crown is the one that started the colony. 1664, New Jersey, New England, Delaware, they came under English control because the English fought against the Dutch and took over. And they had a broad mixture, though, in those colonies of Protestant churches, including those that adhere to the Reformed faith. So you're seeing, by all of this, a very fine line between the northern colonies, which are dissenting colonies mostly, and from Virginia colony southward are Church of England colonies, where the government is in charge. Now, is there anything about a north and south along there that you know anything about? Civil War. We are seeing here the establishment of the line of conflict about slavery. Because the Church of England was the main, or not Church of England, the English government was the major supporter of the importation of black slaves to the southern colonies. Because they wanted those colonies to be financially profitable. And slave labor was the best way to do that. The northern colonies, being established by people that were much more serious about Bible, said, that's wrong. Kidnapping people and bringing them here? Because you see, the first slaves were actually prisoners of war. But once the people selling those slaves in sub-Saharan Africa figured out they could make good money by selling these prisoners of war into servitude to the colonies, they started going out and kidnapping people. And then the next progression was the people in the colonies started figuring out, dude, why should we pay for new slaves to be imported? Let's just breed them here. We'll just keep these people as permanent slaves and breed slaves for ourselves. And the northern people in the northern colonies looked at all that and went, that is not Bible. That is not moral. That is not right. And so in most, if not all, of the documentation of the northern colonies, they wrote rules saying you may not enslave people. It's morally indefensible. Now, they would accept indentured servants, but indentured servants were only in their servitude for a contractual period of time. So they did not see that as the bigger problem. They saw this breeding of a particular ethnic group as being immoral. And so that's why I want you to see the Civil War roots are right here in the colonial period. 1684. Pennsylvania gets started by a Quaker by the name of William Penn. Pennsylvania. Penn's Woods. Remember that from school? But you may not remember how that happened. Mr. Penn was the son of a very wealthy man in England. He was so wealthy that King Charles, who needed cash, went to this guy and borrowed money. Well, King Charles was having a hard time paying all that money back to Mr. Penn. When Mr. Penn died, King Charles came up with an alternate payment plan. He said, Mr. Penn, William, I owe your dad an awful lot of money. Would you take a big tract of land in the New World as payment in full? And William said, sure I will, if I can make the rules for who gets to be there. And the king said, fine, you get to do it. And so his rules were all Quakers and all dissenting religious persons, Protestants, will be welcome in Pennsylvania. And so it became one of the huge areas that more colonists started coming to out of Europe, in particular from England. And this is, again, an example of how during the 1600s, you basically have a huge number of Protestants leaving Europe and settling on the eastern seaboard of North America. And they're settling not for economic reasons primarily, but for the fact that they are sick and tired of being persecuted for their faith by the Church of England or by the Church of Scotland or whatever church is in charge of the state back in Europe. They want to come here to North America and be left alone. And so that is why there is such a huge number of Christians that get settled in North America, particularly Protestants, during the 1600s. All right, so that's, by the way, Delaware was part of that land grant that happened at that time, because Delaware had been taken over by the English, remember. It'll be sheared off later by Penn. He'll give it its own independence, and it'll be a Protestant freedom colony. Any questions, comments, observations, shock, alarm, anything? The Amish end up in Pennsylvania because of that, yes, because they are Anabaptists. They are, and of course, that would be one of the ones that you couldn't say the nasty name about in Maryland, but obviously the same thing kind of applied in Pennsylvania. Penn, because his faith had been persecuted so strongly in England, he felt sympathy toward any other Christian minority that was being persecuted by the Church of England. And so he said, all of you are welcome here. Just behave yourselves.
So much persecution all up and down the seaboard. We're trying to make everybody easy to get away from it.
Yes, and that has an awful lot to do with why the culture developed the way it did. The fact that these people came to a place where they wanted to be left alone. See, that's that fierce independent streak that is still part of Americans, right? Just leave me alone, right? That was definitely part of the settlement culture of the Eastern Seaboard, and particularly in religious matters. And when we go, at some point, I'm going to show you some of the excerpts from the constitutions of the original 13 colonies going into states. They will sometimes have written in there, just leave everybody alone. Basically, you can do your Christian faith, but don't pester other people. Leave them alone. Did I see another hand or somebody wanted to make a comment? That's right. When you've got companies get started, a lot of times they will pick up on the culture of the region where they get started. So Pennzoil, because they got started in Pennsylvania, they took that name. Quaker Oil, same reason, because they were where there was a bunch of Quakers and that was part of their history. That became part of it. Quaker Oats, same reason, got started by a Quaker guy. You still see the Quaker dude on the brand, right? With the funny hat and the weird hair. What? Yeah, their factory's in Iowa. And I think they started in Ohio, somewhere there. You've got to remember, though, that originally Pennsylvania went a lot farther westward. The colonies that got started almost all extended in their land grants all the way over to the Mississippi. And then, of course, that's one of the reasons why the English fight the French, because the French wanted to claim that territory for themselves. But that's another story altogether. Okay, next week we will talk about the Great Awakening. And this will be because of something we already talked about today. These people who have been involved in their dissenting from the Church of England. They get their own faith started, their own, we've got to be, you know, going from the Bible, that sort of thing. But once they got established, they started liberalizing. They started being not quite as committed to having a righteous lifestyle. It was just going through the motions. And so you end up having a revival start. And so the Great Awakening is the first huge revival that impacts on North America. And it's also the establishment of Methodism. And the word Methodism is all about the fact that they used a methodology of Bible study and prayer and encouragement of one another. And when it first got started, it was very much a back to the Bible, let's be open and honest with our relationship with God sort of movement. Yes, and but you'll see this happen over and over again. When a group gets started, if it is not really careful and keep a good eye on its leadership in particular, it will soon be infiltrated by liberalism. It just happens. Okay? That's why you hear me warn about it from time to time. And the best way to avoid liberalism in any Christian organization is constant Bible study. That's the only way. I mean, that paired with Bible, obviously, or with prayer, but constant Bible study is the remedy that keeps liberalism from taking hold in congregations and organizations.